Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, April 5th, 2014, and we are here today, thankfully, because the world has not yet gone into a thermonuclear war, and I say thankfully largely due to the work of the LaRouche Organization and Russian President Putin, maybe a few others in Germany and elsewhere, but certainly not thanks to Barack Obama, who seems hell-bent on putting us into a war on behalf of the Queen of England. I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host today, and we're going to be discussing an extremely pertinent topic for American citizens to address, which is that what's happened to our great republic? If you look at the nation as it stands now, you see that there are tens of millions of people who are suffering, not because of anything that has been a natural occurrence, but because of a failure of leadership, a failure of the leading institutions, and a failure in the citizens themselves to address these problems. If you look at our great tradition, you see that because of our Constitution, which was largely the work of Benjamin Franklin and some collaborators, especially Alexander Hamilton, and how that Constitution was then put into working order, again, largely by the genius of Alexander Hamilton, but with the full support of George Washington and leading elements of the Founding Fathers who fought and won the revolution against the British Empire, what they established was an American credit system, a means by which we could invest in the future so that we could develop manufacturing. We could have a consistent advance in agriculture, internal improvements, which included roads and canals and bridges and ports, and along with that, a credit system which made sure that credit would be available to take the latest scientific advances and through innovation turn those into technological progress in improving the productivity of labor, both in terms of energy production and in terms of the physical output per person working in agriculture or in manufacturing. And over the course of our history, this tradition has generally dominated in the sense that we've had progress from generation to generation. Even though we've had very, very few presidents or leading statesmen who embodied that tradition. And what we're going to look at today is what that tradition is in science and culture and what happened to that tradition. And just in terms of getting the discussion started, I'll mention two things that happened in the last century that have been dominant in terms of the present decline of America. The first and the more recent one was the assassination of our last great president, John F. Kennedy, who was going back through his understanding of Franklin Roosevelt and his understanding of what a credit system is, was going back to policies to break us out of the post-war Trumanism, which was a consumer economy, free trade economy, and a repudiation of the American system and a replacement, an attempt to replace it with British system methods. Kennedy was fighting that, and he was killed. And since that time, we've had absolutely no progress in the areas of technology, energy, and science that would translate into an improved standard of living. Sure, we have computers and cell phones. Just try eating them. Now, the other event is something that's a little more remote and probably completely remote to most people listening to this program. And that's why I've invited our good friend Jason Ross to be the guest today to shed some light on this event, which gets to the heart of the relationship between science and statecraft, the issue that Lyndon LaRouche has been taking up repeatedly of Zeus versus Prometheus. And I'm referring to an event. It's not really an event. This event is sort of a watermark in it, but it's a trend. But an event in 1900 of a conference on mathematics, in which Hilbert stepped forward on behalf of the British Empire, whether he knew it or not, and carried out a systemic destruction of the scientific tradition that went from Kepler through Leibniz through Gauss, Riemann, and into Planck and Einstein. Now, this attack on real science, as Jason will elaborate in a moment, is why we have an unqualified citizenry right now. And if you're angry that I say that, just think about it. Bush was elected or put into office in 2000. In 4 years, it was clear he was the most incompetent and immoral president we've ever had, yet he was allowed to be reelected 4 years later. Whether it was fraud in Ohio or not isn't the point. Enough people voted for him to come back in. Obama was elected in 2008, largely through fraud again, this time by Soros and the disruption of the ordinary functioning of the Democratic Party convention process. But after 4 years of Obama, in which he proved to be everything Bush was and worse, how did he get reelected? That's on the citizens. That's on you guys. And in order to change it, we need for people to think seriously about this question of science and statecraft. So with that introduction, let me bring to the mic here Jason Ross. How you doing, Jason?
Doing well, Harley. Hi there.
Now, you've just written a paper that goes into some of these issues in the broad sense, and of course, Lyndon LaRouche has written about four papers, and we're not going to go through and systematically evaluate and analyze everything that he said, but in broad topics, one of the major points he's made, which you elaborate in your article, is the absolute evil and the importance of this evil of Lord Bertrand Russell. So why don't we begin with you just introducing people to why Lyndon LaRouche talked about the Satan which still exists in Bertrand Russell's dead corpse.
Well, the issue of Bertrand Russell is one that LaRouche has been addressing for a long time, naturally, since he's been around for a long time. I mean, Mr. LaRouche's biggest paper on it in 1994 was called How Bertrand Russell Became an Evil Man. And that's one that listeners can look up and find online, and it's very, very conclusive back then as well. Let me just read one quote from Russell that Mr. LaRouche used in that paper. It's from a paper Russell wrote called Prospects of Industrial Civilization. So here's Bertrand Russell. He said, "Socialism, especially international socialism, is only possible as a stable system if the population is stationary or nearly so." He doesn't mean sitting around, he means the number of people. "A slow increase might be coped with by improvements in agricultural methods, but a rapid increase must in the end reduce the whole population to penury. The white population of the world will soon cease to increase. The Asiatic races will be still longer, and the Negroes no longer before their birth rate falls sufficiently to make their numbers stable without help of war and pestilence. Until that happens, the benefits aimed at by socialism can only be partially realized, and the less prolific races will have to defend themselves against the more prolific by methods which are disgusting, even if they are necessary." So here you have in this one quote Russell's racism, his desire to reduce the population, and his willingness to use means that he considers disgusting and necessary, such as war and pestilence, in order to maintain the population in a stable condition. That is the exact opposite of what the human species does characteristically, which is not to be stable. Unlike any other form of life on this planet, our most characteristic behavior is that we change from generation to generation, that we can change from generation to generation. And we do that by discovering new ways of thinking that always involve throwing out aspects of our old thinking, to increase our power over nature, to increase our numbers, and to become an increasingly powerful force of nature itself. I mean, at this point, the human species moves more Earth than volcanoes do on the planet. So we have demonstrated this increasing power. Now, on Russell, he acted in many ways to prevent this from happening. He acted in many ways as a representative of the British Empire, which is just the most recent in a long line of empires and imperial outlooks, going back to Zeus and Prometheus, you know, thousands of years ago.
Jason, let's yeah. go back, just take a look at this question then of where Russell fits in, because, of course, the American Revolution was made against the British Empire. The Queen of England, the current Queen, has herself repeatedly spoken about the need to reduce the population of the world by 6 billion. The
right.
quote you read from Russell, and then a similar one from his Impact of Science on Society, is explicit in endorsing depopulation by whatever means necessary, including genocide. Yet he has a reputation of being a philosopher, a scientist, a peacenik. How did this happen?
Well, that's what you call psychological warfare. I mean, Russell's idea of peace was, as long as there's one world government, basically the empire's government, then we'll have peace forever. And that's the kind of peace he wanted throughout his life. I mean, he always sought to solidify the possibility of world empire. After World War II and the U.S., the foolish use of the bomb by Truman against Japan, Russell saw that as an opportunity to force the Soviet Union into submission, have one world government, and then that's the kind of peace that he wanted. And he wrote a lot of books. He wrote books on aspects of science, on mathematics, etc. He painted himself as an intellectual. The thing is, he wasn't just some, you know, bookworm who's reading things out of interest. He was an operative for this imperial outlook. And in the books that he did write, the works that he did do in science, supposedly, or mathematics, they're evil. I mean, it's a little bit harder to get at it. It's a little bit harder to realize what was so bad about what David Hilbert proposed at that 1900 International Congress of Mathematicians.
And this is what we want to get into, Jason. Obviously,
right.
we can't go into detail, but you wrote something in our friend Phil Rubenstein has insisted on this point, that it's the Principia Mathematica of Russell, which is his key contribution to the British Empire and its evil policy. And, you know, I think this is where people start, you know, they say, okay, you read the quote, yes, obviously he wants to kill people, that sounds bad, but didn't he also do some physical science work or some kind of valuable philosophical work on science? So I'd like to dig in a little bit to this question of the relationship between what Hilbert did in 1900 and the magnum opus of Russell's evil in the Principia.
Sure. So what Hilbert wanted to do in 1900, at this conference, what Hilbert had put up there among his different goals was, okay.
Go ahead.
So what Hilbert proposed in 1900 at this mass conference was, he laid out at that conference 10 major problems in mathematics they thought would be important for, you know, moving the study forward. The second one of them is probably the most famous one from that conference, and that's where he wanted to do what's called, he wanted to axiomatize arithmetic. So I know axiomatize, that's not an everyday kind of word. Arithmetic, just, you know, that means adding and subtracting and multiplying and dividing, basic mathematics. What Hilbert said was that, would it be possible to make all of the things we might say about arithmetic purely logical? Now, logic also has a specific meaning. Logic is when you study how groups of statements infer other ones, but you do it by removing the specific things that you're talking about. So I'll give you an example. You know, you might say, if A, then B. If it's raining outside, then I will wear my coat. And the general statement, if A, then B, okay, there's some things you can draw from it. One of them is that if you're not wearing your coat, then it's not raining. That if not B, then not A. And that's true based on logic, regardless of whether you're talking about wearing your coat and it's raining or what kind of ice cream you want to eat or anything else, anything. It's just about how statements fit together. So what Hilbert was trying to do was turn mathematics, which at least had some physical connection, purely into logic. And this is something that Russell, he took up with relish.
Does that mean, Jason, that there would be a formal answer for any question you could come up with?
There'd be a formal way of eventually arriving at all of them. In other words, if everything's based on the axioms at the heart of that logic, then anything that you might ever discover in the future could always be proven based on your assumptions of the present.
So you have a closed system, in a sense.
That is the definition of a closed logical system.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there'd be nothing. You might have new things that are new in the sense that you haven't had them before, but you could never have anything new in the sense that it overturned what you already think.
And whatever you did that was new, you could always resolve from within the existing axiomatic structure of what you know.
Yes, according to this, yes, yeah. That would be true. Right. Which is a very deadly idea for science, because every big scientific breakthrough always proved that something else was wrong. It wasn't an addition, like adding another page to the book of knowledge. It always meant you had to rewrite the whole book. So if Hilbert, what Hilbert was proposing would end science. And Russell thought that was a great idea.
Well, did Hilbert know that that's what he was doing, and did he believe it?
He proposed it as a problem. I'm really not that sure. I mean, Hilbert wasn't as evil. He didn't have the same kind of evil intention that Russell did. I think he was looking at it as somebody who did mathematics, and, it was an interesting question to him. I mean,
but
he should have known it was impossible.
I think the question that comes up is that at that time, 1900, you actually had a whole series of breakthroughs from Einstein, from Planck, the whole question of the relativity and so on that was right around the corner. So do you have any idea that this may have been in anticipation of these breakthroughs or an attack on them or just an attempt to close off anything unknown from disrupting the empire in the future?
I can say that for Russell, that's definitely true. I just can't say that much about Hilbert. I don't really know as much about him. But I know that for Russell, like you pointed it out, this was the time period that this... Let me give a brief timeline. So 1900, there's this conference of mathematicians. Russell is there. He's probably, peeing his pants. He's so excited at this prospect. The same year, Max Planck develops a new physical concept of the quantum to resolve some unsolved paradoxes about how light operates. So you've got a totally new physical idea that says that in some way... the physical universe is not continuous, but that it's discrete. That's a shocking thought that Planck came up with. Meanwhile, you've got the mathematicians trying to end everything. In 1903, Russell wrote his first math book called The Principles of Mathematics, an English title. And that's where he was trying to do what Hilbert wanted to do. 2 years later, 1905, is Einstein's Annus Mirabilis, his miracle year, where Einstein writes papers on the Brownian motion, the photoelectric effect, which really solidifies the concept of the quantum. He writes about E equals mc squared, the fundamental equivalence, the possible equivalence between mass and energy, and he writes his paper on special relativity. So all of this happens in 1905. Now, these are very exciting breakthroughs. They change the way that we look at everything. They prove that there is no absolute time and space or motion. They prove that continuum doesn't seem to exist for physics. And then, how does Russell respond? Between 1910 and 1913, he writes the Principia Mathematica, same title as his earlier book, but now in Latin, which is several volumes large. He tries to do this task of removing anything except for logic, for mathematics. And then in 1916, 3 years later, Albert Einstein writes his paper on general relativity. And then 15 years after that, Kurt Gödel proves that Russell's whole thing was fundamentally impossible.
Okay, so now let's because this is so important.
Right.
This is so important, Jason. And again, it does get to the question. I want to just, in a moment, add another timeline to that, which was the British Empire's motion towards World War I. But in the timetable you just gave, was there a relationship between Einstein and Russell? Was Einstein aware of what Russell was doing? Obviously, Russell was aware of what Einstein and Planck were doing.
You know, I really don't know. I if Einstein was aware of what Russell is doing, I think he wouldn't have found it very interesting, though. I mean, it's just boring. You know, it's the sort of thing that Einstein just wouldn't have been interested in following up at all, I imagine. The thing is, what Russell was trying to do, people like Kuza or Kepler had already, Kepler had certainly proven it was already wrong hundreds of years before. It's the sort of thing that nobody who was actually trying to make progress would be interested in doing. It's sort of the, you know, for a mathematician, it's sort of the final solution.
Well, and let me just throw in another name who was just beginning to do some very important work in that period, Vernadsky, who also had a very different conception, rather than a closed system, of potential for nonlinear development, especially in terms of his concept of the phase space of noetic life, human creative activity. So this was another investigation which goes directly against the axiomatic structure of Hilbert and Russell.
Exactly. And what Vernadsky had showed was that if you try to determine all of the laws of nature, and you're doing it in an abiotic physics laboratory to discover all of these physical laws, that you are not going to have life. That there are unique principles about the biosphere itself that don't come out of things that you discover looking at non-life. And similarly, when you look at the human species, to try to have a science of the human species, which the effects of which Vernadsky called the noosphere, he said the noosphere has its own laws. It has them in common with the biosphere and the what he called the lithosphere, non-living processes, but there's something unique about the human individual. So the same way that what Russell was doing would have ended science with the non-living, Vernadsky is saying that in that domain, you will never be able to explain the processes that are occurring in a higher one. It's just like what Kepler did in the early 1600s, when he proved that using math to explain the planets couldn't possibly work. That you have to use physics. That you have to say, why are the planets moving? Not just, how do you model their motion?
You're listening to Jason Ross, who's a member of the basement team of scientific research, who's written a lot on these subjects. You can find things. Jason, your latest piece is on LaRouchePack.com, right?
Yeah, it's on LaRouchePack.com, and it's also in the either latest or upcoming, not sure if it's published yet, issue of EIR.
Okay, and we're discussing, for those of you who joined us late, we're discussing these questions of scientific method, and also in the case of Bertrand Russell, the attack on the scientific method going back to Kuza and Kepler, and its relationship to the brain-dead political universe we live in today. And as we develop this point, I think some of these things become self-evident, but I've asked Jason to demonstrate that it's not really self-evident, because when you're dealing with the human mind and human creativity, there's nothing self-evident except the potential for change. So what we're looking at here is how a decision was made by Bertrand Russell to choke off and end that tradition of scientific and technological progress, including an attack on the traditions of the United States. Now, Jason, I think this is just worth, you know, we've just, with your timeline, you showed two essentially, a branch point, maybe at 1900, with two completely different approaches. Given that it is provable that the approach of Planck and Einstein corresponds to the real physical universe, how has the Russell view become so dominant?
It is ironic, isn't it? Because you'd think people would look back and, like, why would anybody bother caring about what Russell says about anything? He never discovered anything. Who cares what some guy who never discovered anything, who cares what he thinks about scientific method? Why would he talk about it? It would be like if somebody had never written a piece of music, but then wrote books about how to write music. Or somebody who never wrote a poem, wrote books about how to compose poetry. Why would anyone bother reading what they wrote?
Actually,
they
I think we, Jason, I think we have textbooks that cover both of those things. I think that's part of the problem.
Sorry, you know what? Okay, even if it doesn't make, you're right. Yeah, right. That's actually a lot of what happens. That's what a lot of textbooks do. And that's what happened with Russell. So it wasn't that he had such great ideas. It was that he was promoted. He was specifically promoted. And the other thing is that he did have, this is something the oligarchy doesn't even have as much today, is people who, while not intelligent or creative, at least put in a hard day's work in the way that he did. So that, you know, the work that he did, he was as thorough as you could be while still being wrong. So, he put a lot into it. But, I mean, it's sort of shocking because in 1931, Gödel proved that there was no way you could have a logical system that was complex enough to describe arithmetic, and arithmetic's not very complex. He said any system complex enough to describe arithmetic would always have contradictions in it. That if you try to formalize and make logical all of your knowledge in a certain field, there's always going to be a paradox. Now, Nicholas of Cusa, for example, already knew that if you're ever trying to understand something in a way that's less than the process itself, in other words, whenever your knowledge of something is incomplete, there is always something wrong that you're going to think. There's always a wrong conclusion that you could draw. And those wrong conclusions are the way to reach yourself towards the truth. It's like when you're talking to someone about politics, for example, if they've got wrong ideas, there's always, well, often they show up very quickly, but there's always something that someone is going to be wrong about. And that was Socrates' method. You know, people have beliefs, they're not right, they cause contradictions between different things that they think, and then they resolve it by coming up with a new idea in which it's not a contradiction anymore.
Now, Jason, on Gödel, Gödel was at Princeton University. How close was he to Einstein, and was Einstein aware of what he was doing?
Yes, they were close. They were friends. I think that a quote attributed to Einstein, that some days he would go to work just so he could have the pleasure of walking home later with Gödel at the end of the day. So, because by this time, I mean, Einstein had become isolated towards the end of his life, not because of something wrong that he did, but because he was under attack by the quantum mechanics of Bohr and others.
Did this go back to the Solvay conference?
Exactly, yes. Because Einstein never accepted the idea that quantum mechanics was done. I mean, basically, Bohr not only said that the universe is fundamentally random and there's things we can't explain about it, and that's just sort of part of the weirdness of quantum mechanics, which, you know, there is no satisfactory solution to it right now that isn't kind of weird. But Bohr went further and also said that we were done. So what he figured out was it. That was the answer. We got quantum mechanics all figured out. Einstein never believed that. He didn't believe that the universe was fundamentally random. You know, there's this quote from him that God doesn't play dice. Anyway, so, you know, later in his life, Einstein was seen as sort of a guy who figured things out but then didn't keep up with the times. So he was somewhat isolated. And Gödel was one of the people that he was able to really discuss things with. So Einstein and Gödel certainly were collaborators and friends. And then Gödel, too, towards the end of his life, he was isolated, attacked, and somewhat driven insane, I believe, by the attacks against him.
Well, Lynn, in writing on this, said that what Gödel did was useful as far as it went, but he had a fundamental critique of it, and I think that's relevant going back to this question of Riemann's discovery from the habilitation dissertation. I mean, maybe you can say something about that.
Yes, because what Gödel had done, he proved that what Russell was doing would never work. But he didn't, prove what creativity is. He proved Russell was an idiot, but he didn't in the same paper also describe what genius was. Riemann's habilitation dissertation it was from 1854. Give a little bit of very quick background on it. It was it was the thought that really put an end, for at least people who knew what he said, to Euclidean geometry. Now, when we say Euclidean geometry, people people who are familiar with Mr. LaRouche know that he is no fan of Euclidean geometry. He hates it. Hated it since he was in school.
But it's still taught to everyone today, right? Isn't that what our geometry courses in high school are?
It is. And the problem with it isn't so much that every, you know, thing that we do in geometry class is wrong as geometry. I mean, you know, if the angles of this are always double the angles of that on a circle, okay, that's not untrue. The real problem with what Euclid did was, I'd say, twofold. One is that he assumed space was flat. Now, real physical space is not flat. So right off the bat, his geometry doesn't describe the real universe. So it's already an abstraction. It's not a, it can't be a real thing. The other thing is that Euclid, who was brought in by the librarian of the Library of Alexandria to pull together the math department, he had access to all of these different books and writings about how discoveries in geometry had been made. And what Euclid did was he completely, totally threw away the discovery process. Hmm. Instead of discoveries, he presented proofs. So he'll say, I'm going to show you that this thing about geometry is true. And here are the steps and the proofs. And you can follow them and say, okay, yeah, every step followed. I guess that's a true statement. But you'd say, well, but why did somebody think about that in the first place? How did it get figured out? And that's not there. So instead of discovery, you've got this thing that we talked about earlier, that everything that might ever happen in geometry is already inherent in those initial axioms. So it's done. It's dead. Geometry is basically over with Euclid. And people realized that he wasn't really right because they couldn't prove this. I'm not going to get into details, but basically this parallel postulate about whether how parallel lines work. But what Riemann did in 1854 is he tore apart the entire Euclidean framework. He said, look, this guy wasn't just wrong about some specific formula he had about lines or a statement about triangles. His whole approach is wrong because, A, there's a lot of shapes of space, and we shouldn't assume that his is the shape of space, of real space, without actually doing some experiments. And second, the foundation of geometry should not be mathematical rules. The foundation of geometry has to be our physical understanding of why things happen the way they do, what causes things to occur in the universe. That's the basis of geometry, and it's an unending basis. We're never going to be done discovering those things that give space its shape. So it's the height of folly to try to finish it and say, we're done. Here's geometry. And Riemann, beautifully, in a reasonably short paper, did all of that. He demolished it, and he said, in a very understated sentence, that, well, that's all we can do in the math department, and now we go to the physics department, which we're not going to discuss today in this lecture. So basically, that's the end of it. That's it. We're done with this math. We're done with math as the basis of geometry. You can still do it, and there's things to be done with it, but if you're trying to say the basis of physical, basically he's saying for science should not be held back and have to prove itself based on math axioms.
Well, and what this gets to, I think, is where we started with this question of how does a nation progress? What is it that enables one nation to make or to encourage discoveries and then to assimilate those discoveries for the benefit of all? And I think this gets to the deeper point that Mr. LaRouche is discussing, which is the nature of man and the nature of human creativity. I assume that the point here is that while you look at Riemann and Planck and Einstein as almost infinitely creative individuals, or perhaps infinite is the wrong word, but highly creative individuals, this is something that would irritate a Russell.
For sure.
And I think this gets then to the question of the relationship between an empire, which is interested in suppressing those kinds of individuals, versus a republic for which the mission of a republic is to increase the numbers of those creative individuals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, if you do a thought experiment for yourself, try to put yourself in the... It's very difficult to try to imagine that you're running an empire, but you put yourself in those shoes and try to figure out, okay, what are all the ways I'm going to maintain the control of my empire? Well, I don't want other people to become stronger than me, other nations or other groups. I also have to look out for revolution from within the territory I control. So I have to control the people. Various ways of doing that. I can throw them in prison if they disagree with me. That's pretty straightforward, but costly. If I control the culture, if I control the way people think, in a way that they don't notice it, is certainly the best way of doing it, then you don't have to bother with, putting people in chains and throwing them in prison. They do it themselves. Like people do it today, where we've got American citizens of the greatest republic on this planet, who have within themselves the power, as a nation, to totally transform the direction the world's going in, to end this British push towards thermonuclear war, to get Glass-Steagall to embark in economic progress as we have in our greatest periods. You've got citizens of this sort, like you were saying in your introduction, Harley, who are they prevented from doing that by laws that throw them in prison for expressing those views? Not exactly. But what do people actually do with their time? What's the culture like? What do people do to entertain themselves? What do people think the nature of the universe is? Do people think that human beings are fundamentally awful anyway?
Well, this is where you see them. This is where you see LaRouche's polemic against sense perception and sense certainty, because that seems to be adequate for most people. They're not looking for deeper, more profound explanations. They're very happily comfortable with popular opinion on these things.
Right, and the thing is, it does have to get pushed on you, because it's a bit unnatural. As people familiar with children, as some of them are aware, you don't get that. It's not something that you just draw as a conclusion about the human species from looking at babies discovering how to make sense of what they see around them and use their arms and walk and talk and all of these things. That's a creative process. So the idea that human beings are fundamentally a plague and a pox and, well, depopulation. I mean, that's been the name of the game for the empire literally for thousands of years, since 1500 B.C. Empires have said that the world is overpopulated. So, the Queen of England's push specifically around that failed Copenhagen conference to say, really I got to get the world population way, way, way down. That's a very depressing and disgusting and evil outlook. And it's really not natural to the human species. But for most of actual history, most people have lived under empires of various sorts. They've lived as over most of that span, most people were not even free people, serfs, slaves.
Well, to what extent, just to extrapolate from that, to what extent is science today limited in its practice by the effect of Russell? I mean, one of the things that LaRouche talks about oftentimes is scientists who are willing to discuss ideas, but when they try to prove them, they go to the blackboard and try to prove them mathematically. Is that a product of Russell's operation?
It is. It is. It's a product. I mean, there's a specific Russell influence. There's also a more general thing that, even Friedrich Schiller wrote about, certainly before that, about people in academia who are trying to maintain their reputations or positions who just don't like new ideas anyway.
Yeah, the bread scholar.
Right. People who are in it for the you got your PhD, you got your professorship, you don't want some new person coming up with a new theory, you just want to, while away the end of your years, and you want to be respected. So, yeah, in science, like you said about the person who's got to prove what they saw, this is what Mr. LaRouche had always been complaining about in the fusion community in particular, where people were doing experiments, they found out that the laws of physics weren't what everybody said they were, and they'd go to a conference to describe what they'd seen and what they thought was going on, and they were told, well, you got to prove that you observe what you observe. Now, if you discovered something new, you did an experiment where no one would have expected what came out of it. Well, you can't prove what you saw. You can't prove what you got because it means you need something new. And so, yes, that's exactly the Russell thing. Basically we're all done. Science is all done. Like, you know, some of these things about, you know, what happened in the first nanosecond of the universe after the Big Bang, these are just stupid things for people to talk about.
But Jason, I know you were at a Kepler conference a few years ago in Prague. Aren't they now taking these same assumptions and trying to impose them on people who did make discoveries previously?
You mean, like, go back and rewrite their work, you mean? Or?
Yeah, more or less.
Yes. Well, yeah, and that's why, like, Kepler, for example, is such a controversial figure. I was at this conference. There was this rather unpleasant woman there who supposedly, you know, among the world's greatest experts on Kepler's new astronomy. She had no clue what he did. She had a completely mathematical approach. I mean, she was a mathematician. And she even was, it's funny, like she considered herself an expert on this guy. She was actually attacking what Kepler had done. The physical aspect of what his hypothesis was, she was saying was what didn't even exist in the book. I mean, she was just actually making up things about what he did and didn't say that were kind of embarrassing to see. But
anyway, outside of you, there wasn't an uproar over this, was there?
No, not really. It wasn't that conference wasn't exactly a huge brawl.
Well, that's why I'm saying I've recently been discussing this question of the rewriting of history, the way, for example, Obama and John Kerry are rewriting this last decade. You know, when they say of the Russian move into the Crimea, they're saying in the 21st century we don't attack other countries without that go against policies of international law. Well, what about Iraq? What about Libya? What about Ukraine? You know, the overthrow of a democratically elected government, we just did that. So what are they talking about? It's very much like the character Winston Smith in Orwell's 1984, whose job was to go back into old newspapers and rewrite articles so that if they were at war with Oceania, they had to rewrite the newspapers to say, we've always been at war with Oceania and at peace with Eurasia.
Right, I mean, right.
You have that in history. You have that in politics. And certainly what you're describing, you have that in science and the attempt to say that, well, what Kepler did was just extend the work of Brahe and everything else is just esoterica and mysticism.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it's like what you were describing about Kerry, is like the behavioral economist. Like, you know, you don't, or like Leo Strauss or something, where, you know, when they make these statements, does Kerry actually believe any of that stuff? Who knows? Probably not. It's when words become, when you're not even really honestly trying to pretend that what you're saying is true, they're just sort of a way of making policy. They say, you know, we want this, so we're going to say whatever we're going to say about the world to get what we want, to make things go the way we want. And if we get caught, then, well, I don't know, we'll sort of worm our way out of it. But there's not even it doesn't even matter.
But you have that. You have that in economics. You have even the International Monetary Fund does a critique of its policy in Greece, saying, well, we had the wrong assumptions, the wrong model. Everything we did failed. Now we've got to do it more. And this is where you see how this kind of attack on creativity, an attack on the individual geniuses who made creative discoveries, is designed to reduce people to creatures of habit and sense perception.
Right.
And that's how we ended up with the second term of Obama, probably how we ended up with the first term of Obama as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this method of Russell, this thing that he had introduced, it seems abstract. People might say, wait, Lyndon LaRouche is writing about a 1900 conference of mathematicians, and this is supposedly important today? I've never been to a mathematician's conference. I don't even know any mathematicians. Well, yes, it is. I mean, I think we've just been discussing a lot of the different fields, whether it's science, which is very explicit, where, you know, people are told that science is based on mathematics, or at least that the way you're going to formulate any new principles you discover is in the language of mathematics. And then when you throw away a standard of truth, then you start getting also what you described about the IMF and other things.
I'll give you another example. Mm-hmm. Modern economics, what they call the quants, the quantified theorists who tried to apply what they speak of quantitative methods of analysis to create derivatives, and they had all these formulas, mathematical formulas, mm-hmm. which they said proved that they were doing the right thing. And what it proved is that if you can run swindles with no regulators, you can make money in a bubble until the bubble pops. But
right.
How is it that if they were so good with math, they couldn't predict that the bubble would pop?
Well, that's what they always say at the end. Well, nobody could have predicted this. That's why they keep having to use that refrain.
So
wrong, but so is everybody else.
Well,
so,
this gets to another question then that Lyndon LaRouche has been discussing a lot, which is the question of forecasting.
Right.
That the future is something that's knowable, but not in a sense perception sense, but through hypothesis. And I'd like you to discuss that a little bit.
Sure. Well, if you think about, there's a lot of different ideas of the future. I mean, the future might be you see a snail walking forward and you figure out how far it might go in a certain amount of time or something. There's some sense of the future that is predictable from what's happening now and what happened in the past. Nothing in the universe is really that predictable. I mean, some things are more than others, but for example, the human species, of course, isn't, not just because we have free will, but because when given options A and B, we can choose option C. The flank is seen in strategy. The new discovery is seen in science, where what is possible in the future, it's not just that, you thought A was going to happen and B happens instead. It's when you realize there's a whole domain of possibilities that you never knew existed. And that's what economic progress really does. That's what big breakthroughs like electrification did, or the development of the steam engine, or domestication of animals, or agriculture, or any of these things. Those are the real exciting things in economics. Those are the things that totally transform the very nature of what the future could be. And those are all the things that aren't included in economic modeling. It's the exact same sort of end of the final solution. Again, Russell Gott was looking for the final solution in mathematics. Economists are looking for the final solution of economics, the final way of modeling, But it excludes huge shifts, which today would mean, for example, fusion energy, fusion power. That will completely overturn almost everything that people think about economics right now. What formula is predicting that? None of them.
Well, I think that's also where you see the complete insanity of closing out programs and cutting back programs in fusion research where they say, well, we don't think this is going to get us to break even. Or
right.
In space research where they say, well, we've already been to the moon, as Obama said. We don't have to do that again. And so you actually see the same kind of Russellite small-mindedness, which is to some extent is endemic in the whole population right now.
Right. It is, because you need to have, it becomes endemic when there's no counter idea that's presented or accessible to people. So, you go to school, let's say a high schooler today, is grown up under only Bush and Obama. So some of us are old enough to remember the good old days of at least Bill Clinton. Some of us the better days of Kennedy.
Yeah.
Like kids today, they've grown up under these terrible presidents. They've got this green agenda being hammered away at them that really the best thing they could do is not exist, or maybe find out a way to make the human species effectively not exist. That's the highest goal of a greenie, right? Have no impact on anything. Don't exist. Not exactly a very inspiring or optimistic outlook. So if you get hit on all sides from these things, incredibly boring, terrible music about unimportant themes that with very little musical development. Okay, that's not exactly very inspiring. This green idea that you should just basically not exist, and then video games, porn, just nonsense everywhere. So there's no, you know, where is the beautiful culture? Where is the real science? How many kids are doing actual experiments as opposed to simulations on an iPad? You know, you don't get to be acquainted with the real universe. And that's a very important thing that Mr. LaRouche has been insistent that we make sure to provide for some of our newer associates in our movement and in those soon to be. That, you know, we have a system of training that repairs these defects, that elaborates the real idea. Okay, you know, let's go through what Kepler did. Let's find out what did Einstein do. How did the Pythagoreans come up with the Pythagorean theorem? What was Socrates like as a person? You know, reliving this rich and beautiful history of loving upward development, and that's the real, you know, patrimony of us as a human species, not you know, hot dogs and fireworks.
Well, that is what you've been doing in the basement in recent years in terms of studying and working through these great discoveries. But, you know, you come up against a problem, which is that the population as a whole is living through these ironies, these paradoxes, and may be frustrated by them, may at times be angry about it. But what does it take to get people to have the toughness and integrity to basically fight for truth? I mean, why is it people will accept a comfort zone which is increasingly uncomfortable? I guess the question that LaRouche is getting at is, this is what leadership does. Leadership makes people uncomfortable in their comfort zones.
Right.
And that, I guess, is what, that's the Socratic method. That's the use of paradox.
Right. We need a lot more Socrateses. And then, you know, what pulls people out is, sometimes you don't want to admit there's a problem until you see a solution. You know,
yeah.
like sometimes if people, you know, sometimes people think, you know, I don't really want to go to the doctor because I don't know if they could do anything about this. You know, you just maybe don't want to find out about a problem. But I think that's very important. What we're doing is that we've got a very worked out solution. So we've got these, you know, we've got these programs. You know, we've got Glass-Steagall. We've got a credit system. We've got specific projects to use that credit towards, such as, you know, WAPA 21, which will transform our continent and our relationship to it. We've got the drive for fusion. I mean, that's the thing, is like a sense of history also, of economic history, of, you know, what these, for example, the latest special report from 21st Century Science and Technology magazine on physical chemistry, the continuing gift of Prometheus, which you can find on Amazon, physical chemistry, the continuing gift of Prometheus. If you read through that report, you know, the idea is, well, we need fusion today, but let's put that in the context. What has been, in very broad strokes, what's been the history of the human species? What are the biggest breakthroughs that move this forward? So in that report, we take up four basic fields of metallurgy, chemistry, electricity, and nuclear science, each of which caused tremendous changes, basically redefining us as a species. And that's the kind of thing that we're talking about doing now. That's the level of the quality of the change that fusion would need now, the space program would need now. It doesn't mean increasing the economy and getting our GDP growth rate to go up 3 more percentage points a year or something like that.
This is the issue of Zeus and Prometheus at its heart, because on the one side you have the idea of powers that are too powerful and will not allow change, and you have to submit to their authority. And that, as in the case of Zeus, were he to decide to do so, he could wipe out the human race. On the other side, you have the Promethean, that is the individual who, in order to defend the human race, has to use the highest powers of creativity. In the case of the Prometheus Aeschylus story, fire. But
right.
Fire also is very, he's explicit. He talks about astronomy and medicine and all the things which he gave to man. So you look at this question historically, and you see that the fight, again, is this fight of an oligarchical would-be god who has physical power, a certain amount of psychological power, and a population which is subservient but is capable of being moved by a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we are today, where if we don't have that kind of leadership step forward, and of course, I'm here in Texas where we're working on the Keisha Rogers campaign, where we actually have demonstrated that an individual can take on the Democratic Party and the Republican Party.
Absolutely.
And the media and popular opinion and can still win an election. So once
Right.
you've seen that happen, doesn't that demonstrate a kind of unique experiment that could happen elsewhere?
Right. Yes. I think it's a very inspiring experiment that people and other, you know, people can take heart from, take courage from, and it's a, as you said, it's a very good indicator of what the power is of the truth.
And this leads us to the other question, which we're not going to have time to get into today, Jason, but we do have about 4 minutes, the relationship between science and classical culture. We didn't mention this, but Planck and Einstein were both classical musicians, Planck a pianist, Einstein a violinist. You have all these stories of the German scientists who would work in their labs during the day and have Musikabends at night. This is also part of the Russell tradition, the creation of a culture which is homogenized and horrible.
Right.
And, you know, just for a moment, give us your thoughts on this question of this interrelationship of science and culture.
So that's a good example. I mean, Planck played the piano, Einstein played the violin, and Russell played with himself. I mean, these...
And
you know,
prostitutes.
Yeah, right. That was the kind of playing he did.
He was a real pervert on top of everything else.
Well, in terms of music, just in the briefest of terms, that there's, if you look at music as, you know, because, you know, poems have words. They talk about things. Science obviously refers to things in the world around us, even though it's really, in a sense, addressing our mind. Music is one of the purest ways of directly presenting to somebody a concept of the mind, that you hear music, obviously it has sound, you know, as Beethoven found, if you're deaf, it makes it much harder, you know, that's the limit to music, but
sure.
the music in it isn't the sounds, it's what's being said. So, you know, you think about, you know, sometimes there's a simple way of looking at it is if our listeners take the classical music challenge, and, you know, spend a good period of time really listening to creative music, like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven. This does not include putting your radio on the classical station, because they play a lot of crap and sort of aimed towards waiting rooms, I think, during the day, not real music. But if you compare that with then what you just hear generally on the radio or in the grocery store, like, well, what kind of person are they addressing? What kind of person is going to find that to be the sort of thing that they want to do with their mind? Like, you know, Planck or Einstein, would they want to listen to today's pop music? Is it because they're stuffy old white men that they wouldn't? Or is there a different reason? Do they have something going on where they need to take care of their mind? Like take drug use. You know, people say, well, why can't I use drugs? It makes me feel good. It's a plus experience, et cetera. It's not hurting anybody. Well, it does hurt your mind. And the whole question takes on a different meaning when you're actually trying to do something with your mind. When it matters, when your mind matters, you look at it a lot differently. And you don't want to waste your possibilities by scrambling it up or just sort of checking out for a while.
Well, I think this really does show that there's a lot of work that has to be done by the listeners. They can start by looking at your paper, and also I think there are about 4 or 5 papers from Mr. LaRouche that are up on the LaRouchePack.com website, including especially his one about the satanic soul of Russell speaking through his dead corpse. That's not exactly the title, but...
Right.
Obviously, this is a very rich area of investigation, and Jason, I'd like to thank you for your work on this and also for coming on and trying to make this intelligible for people. And obviously, this is a task we have to take up, because it's not just a question of getting rid of a British imperial flunky in Obama, but making sure that this kind of control control over our country never happens again, and the only way that will happen is if we have a population which is mobilized and able to think in the tradition of the great creative scientists and those who made breakthroughs in economics and statecraft. So, Jason, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks.
And this wraps up another edition of the LaRouche Show. We will be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern as usual. And in the meantime, go early and often to LaRouchePack.com and organize your friends to become thinkers. Thanks, and that's all for today.